Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'm speaking with my friend Lisa Sharon Harper of Freedom Road. This is a project of beatitudecenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus, practicing nonviolence, and working for a more just, more nonviolent world. So let's begin with a little prayer, as usual. So I invite you just to take a deep breath wherever you are and to relax and recenter yourself. Notice how you're feeling. And let's all enter into the presence of the God of peace who loves you infinitely, personally, and everyone everywhere. And we welcome the risen nonviolent Jesus here with us and ask for whatever grace you need to follow the nonviolent Jesus more faithfully and to do God's will. God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life, love, and peace that you give us. Be with us now as we reflect together on your call to follow the nonviolent Jesus and work for a more nonviolent, more just world. Bless us, inspire us, disarm us, strengthen us, and send us out to do your will, to do our part, to help end poverty, racism, greed, injustice, war, nuclear weapons, fascism, sexism, environmental destruction, and all violence, that we might be who you created us to be, your holy peacemakers, your beatitude people, and welcome your reign of universal love, nonviolence, and peace on earth. In Jesus' name, amen. It's a great blessing to welcome my friend Lisa Sharon Harper. Lisa was a leader at Sojourners Magazine and then went off and founded Freedom Road, which you can look up at freedomroad.us. She's a theologian, writer, speaker, activist, and trainer who has worked from Ferguson and Charlottesville to South Africa, Brazil, Australia, and Ireland. Her book, Fortune, How Race Broke My Family and the World and How to Repair It All, was named the 2022 Book of the Year by Word and Way. Her book, The Very Good Gospel, was named the 2016 Book of the Year by the Englewood Review of Books. Lisa is host of the Freedom Road podcast and has a column on Substack. Huffington Post identified Lisa as one of 50 women religious leaders to celebrate on International Women's Day. Good going, Lisa. Hey, Lisa, welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus podcast.
It's really good to be with you, John. It's so fun.
Good.
To be with you and your community.
Just want to jump right into it. Are you ready? Into the deep end.
Sure.
The horrors and injustices of our country and our world from, I don't even know where to begin, you know, Trump, fascism, white supremacy, to taking away voting rights and civil rights, permanent warfare, abolishing all the pro-human resources for the poor at home and abroad, the treatment of women and children at home and around the world, and really now a country totally at the service of billionaires, and the ongoing threat with nuclear weapons to the planet and with fossil fuels, the coming of total climate chaos. I hear your dog in the background.
Yeah, I'm going to shut the door.
Okay. He's upset. It's all so depressing and overwhelming to me, but we do need to name it and talk about it. And I thought it would be helpful, and I've been asking everybody this, to just share what are your thoughts on what's happening right now in the country and the world, however you want to take that.
Well, I mean, you know, I have to say, John, that's a really, of course, a really heavy question.
Yes,
what are your
of
thoughts
course.
On the world? The whole
yeah,
world
yeah.
Right
okay, it was a little over the top. So,
No. I'm happy to answer it, but it is a big loaded question. I do. Here's how I would begin to engage that question is, you know, it helps me first to feel it. And when I feel it, I weep. I mean, I really do weep. I weep a couple times a day, kind of every day. And I'm not depressed that I know of. I mean, I'm totally doing stuff. I'm moving. I'm, you know, I actually have hope. I
but
have
you're grieving.
Faith.
You're grieving.
I'm grieving, you know. I think like the rest of the country, I'm grieving. You know, I just today, not to date this recording, but it is important to say that this recording is happening you know, the day before Juneteenth, and is also happening the same day as the opening of the Obama Center and the Presidential Center. And I, you know, you're just reminded of another time, of another America, it feels like, and another church. And it's striking to me that because of the church's silence in the Obama era, with the rise of the Tea Party and so many evil things that had their seeds, you know, in that time. And not only then, but you trace it all the way back to like the 1980s, late 70s, 80s, early 80s, when you had the rise of the religious right, and you had so many churches, church leaders around the country who were just silent. And because of their silence, they didn't have leadership. They didn't know which way is the just way, you know, which way is the right way, which way is the Jesus way. And maybe because of the spiritual formation of our faith, that it was personal, right? It was private, as in our faith can't enter into the public square. It shouldn't actually go beyond me and my priest, you know, me and the rosary, me and my prayers, me and the liturgy, you know, me and the altar, if you're an evangelical. Like, that's where my faith, it's just about me, really. And whether I go to heaven, or whether the brokenness in my life is healed, whether I get to be freed from alcoholism or something. But it had nothing to do with and nothing to say for so many churches about the evil that was already in our society. And, you know, and I'm being generous to start it, of course, in 1980. I mean, it really does go back. We're celebrating 250 years of our nation. It goes back further than that, you know. It's in the Constitution. The evil is embedded in the Constitution. It's embedded in the reality of the Three-Fifths Compromise and the decision, the arguments and the decision that was made to protect the institution of slavery in the founding of our nation, that they could have, and some did argue, to abolish slavery 250 years ago, but they didn't. They chose not to. And so the seeds are here. And so we really shouldn't be surprised that they have come full. I mean, like, we literally have an overgrown garden of those seeds, if you can call it a garden. You know, that's denigrating gardens everywhere, but you know what I mean by that. Overgrown with weeds, maybe. It's a good way to put it. So I grieve for our inaction in the past, because I don't think it had to be this way. It didn't. And yet, at the same time, there has always, in every generation, there has been a remnant. There has been an active force within the church, within every arm of the church, whether you're Catholic or mainline or evangelical, fundamentalist even. I mean, there were in every stream of the church, there's always been a witness of the actual Jesus way of being in the world. And right now, that witness is alive and well, and maybe even growing. And so, you know, that is literally what sustains me. And my call in these days is to be a part of it.
Wow, I'm so glad I asked you that. Thank you for your moving answer. And I know some of your journey, and we've spent time in jail together. We'll get to that.
Yes,
but
yes.
I would love to hear briefly some of your stories, especially from Ferguson and Charlottesville. So let's start with, I think it was August 2014, when Michael Brown was killed mm-hmm. by the white yeah. policeman in Ferguson, and you went there. So share a little about your experience there, what you witnessed, if you would.
Well, oh, absolutely. Well, I have to say this all kind of, it's like a narrative that marches from that time period to right now.
Yeah.
And And you kind of have to start it a year before that, actually. I know we talked earlier about starting it in 2014. I'm sorry to switch it up on you, but 2013 is really in a lot of ways like a huge mile marker, because in June of 2013, that's when the Supreme Court nullified Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. And at the same time, that like literally within 1 month later, you had, I think it was Rand Paul or somebody in the Congress, put forward the Path to Prosperity, and the Path to Prosperity was their proposal for the budget that it would cut 2/3 of the budget on the backs of poor people. And so their path then, I mean, it was like pre-Project 2025, their idea then was to cut the budget like DOGE did, and they were going to do it by cutting programs for poor people back then. And that was put forward 1 month after the Voting Rights Act was initially gutted of Section 4. And then that weekend, Path to Prosperity was put out on a Friday. On Sunday of that same weekend, we got the verdict in the George Zimmerman case. And George Zimmerman, of course, was let off by the jury, who said, yeah, you're right, Trayvon Martin is responsible for his own death. Yeah. because he walked on cement, and he used the cement as his weapon, which is ridiculous. And so George Zimmerman had a right to defend himself. Oh my God. So just in 2013, in a 1 month period, you had all three major accomplishments of the civil rights era were hobbled. The Civil Rights Act through the George Zimmerman verdict and the establishment of the Stand Your Ground laws, the legitimization of it through that court ruling. The Voting Rights Act through the Shelby case, and also the war on poverty through the Path to Prosperity. So you had violence a year before Michael Brown, and then Michael Brown. And Michael Brown came about a month or two after, I believe, Eric Gardner, who was standing on a sidewalk trying to sell some loose cigarettes, and ended up being murdered by a police officer who put him in a chokehold, and he said, "I can't breathe. I can't breathe." And those were his last words. And so a few months after that, maybe a month or two after that, Michael Brown was walking home from a convenience store down on the corner off of Canfield Avenue in Ferguson of Missouri. And he was told by the officer, "Get the F off the street." He was yelled at by the officer, "Get the F off the street." And he just minded his own business. And the officer basically began an argument with him, and then a fight. And then Michael Brown ran. And while he was running, he was shot in the back and killed. And he was made to lay on the ground for 4.5 hours after that, in the hot sun on August, I believe it was August 9th of 2014. I, like everybody else in the country, watched the news reels for the whole first week. And we all saw the violence erupt from the police, who for the first time, this was the first time that we had seen the armored nature of police officers in Midwestern cities. Since they had bought a lot of the armor, literal armor, that had been basically trafficked into United States police departments through the military after the Iraq War. So they bought a bunch of that military gear, and now they were like happy to use it. So they brought tanks out onto the street. They brought, AR-15s, they brought out, all the things. And they began to actually shoot rubber bullets into the crowd. They were treating those crowds in a way that we had not seen. So that's really when it erupted. And I just was watching, and one night I just couldn't stop crying. And I prayed and I said, "God, what is my role here?" Because I was working at Sojourners at the time as their chief church engagement officer. And what's my role? And as I looked around at the people who were protesting, I did a little demographic search and realized that neighboring area is all white. Like, it's surrounded by white communities all around. And yet almost all of the people on the street were Black. So I said, there got to be some good white people out there. So I discerned that my call was to go and to help multi-ethnic churches in particular to engage with the Hands Up, Don't Shoot movement. So a couple of weeks later, I flew into St. Louis, and while I was there, I was joined by Faith in Action, which is a really awesome faith-rooted organizing group across the country. They invited me to work with them over the course of that week. But I, on my own through Sojourners, went out and actually just started to organize these multi-ethnic churches, mostly in the heart of St. Louis, to join the effort. And that really did garner fruit. It actually started a whole movement there called Faith and Justice. And they were very much integrated and partnered with the Ferguson movement. And to this day, those people's lives have been shaped by that. I think what they also, their faith in their faith life, their faith formation was changed by that experience. They began to talk about protest as like a liturgical experience, a sacred experience of connection with God. So, and I can attest that it's absolutely true that the confrontation with the powers that are hell-bent on crushing the image of God on earth is one of the vocations of the church. And it is when we are engaged in that resistance work, nonviolent resistance work, when I believe we are standing in the center of our purpose and, fanning the glory of God.
Oh, thank you. And then a couple of years later, you were in Charlottesville. So I looked up the date. It's August 11th, 2017, when 200 members of white supremacist, neo-Nazi, alt-right, pro-Confederate groups marched on the University of Virginia in Charlottesville with all kinds of horrible slogans like "White Lives Matter," "You Will Not Replace Us," and then "Unite the Right" rally was scheduled for the next day to protest the city council's removal of a Confederate monument dedicated to Robert E. Lee. And that's when they're near Emancipation Park. Some of the white nationalists started attacking the crowd, and that led, as you know, to the killing of a 32-year-old white woman named Heather Heyer. And you went there, or you were there. So tell us about that. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was there. I was actually invited to be a part of the witness of the interfaith, multi-faith witness that was going to be marching to the park. I don't know to this day what their original plan was, but they were told the morning that it began, the morning of the actual Unite the Right march at Emancipation Park, they were told by the police that whatever happened on the street, the police would not protect them. The police actually warned people they would not protect them. And remember, this is Virginia. So that's when I was reminded, oh yeah, that's right. We're in the South and that's for real. And so our crowd went from like 500 that showed up at the church that morning to 80. And so there were 80 people.
Yeah. Including Cornell West. He was there.
Yes. Yeah. So Cornell West, was there and 80 other people. And it was, and I really struggled with whether or not I should go out. My mom was going to be going into surgery. What would happen to my family if my mom passed, or what would happen if I passed? Like, who was going to take of my mom? You know, that thing. It was, you know, and what I heard the Lord say, I just, you know, in my prayers, you hear that still small voice. And I really did sit down, head down, and pray before going out on the street. And I heard God say, take up your cross and follow me. And so I did. So I went out onto the street and joined the group. We walked two by two up to the park. And in that last block, we fanned out and flanked the whole street, took up the whole street. And there's a well-known picture of that now that you can see us walking toward the park. What we're looking at is the park. And we approach the park, and aligning the park were militia groups, each one of whom had an AR-15, and they were protecting the park from being entered by anybody else except for alt-right people. And so we just flanked the park. We basically just lined ourselves up on one edge of the park, and each of us had a militia person in front of us. And for about 2 hours, we literally sang and prayed and had liturgy. And our goal in that moment was to have an alternative witness of how we can be differently in the world. And so it was interfaith. And so it was very multi-ethnic and diverse. And it was nonviolent until it wasn't, right? So it was, our witness was nonviolent, but the violence began when there were masses of alt-right people. You said 200, it might be 200 groups, because there were many more than like 2,000 alt-right people who were there, neo-Nazis and other white Christian nationalists who were there. And the thing that was so freaky about them, the night before that confrontation, we were doing a mass meeting at, I believe it was St. Paul's Church, Episcopal Church, across the street from the campus, where they had the Tiki Torch rally that you also see really a lot of images of when you think about that event. We were having our mass meeting across the street, and while I was speaking, they had actually asked me to be the last speaker at the mass meeting. And while I was speaking, the Tiki Torch guys came and surrounded the church. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know. But when I sat down, I was told, okay, they're going to try to hold everybody in the church because they don't want anybody to leave because they might get beat up or worse. And so we ended up just singing for, it felt like ever, just trying to hold the space and have nobody leave. Someone did leave, and they did get beat up. And but eventually, it all dispersed. Brian McLaren was there as well. And mm-hmm. Tracy Blackman was there, and Cornell West. And we all jumped in a car, actually, afterwards to go take Brian to his car, because he had parked way out kind of in the boonies and walked over. And while we were driving him to his car, we were just surrounded by Tiki Torch guys. It was the most freaky thing in the world. It was so weird, because every last one of them looked like they could be a kid at our church or in the boardroom of the nonprofit we work in, or, you know, the banker behind the teller in the window at the bank. Literally, they just looked like normal white people. Normal white boys and men. And to know that these normal white men were actually Nazis was just surreal. So the next day, when we went out onto the street and we confronted them at the park through nonviolence, it was truly a confrontation of the powers. And again, you know, I felt the sacred nature of that vocation, of the confrontation with the powers. And when we were singing, the song we sang more than anything else was "This Little Light of Mine." This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. And it really did feel like it was battle. It was nonviolent battle. I was inspired in the midst of it, just looking at my counterpart, the militia person. I was inspired to remember that he also bears the image of God. I looked for the image of God behind his hate, his hateful eyes. And I called to him. I said, "Hey, hey." And he tried to ignore me. And we finally actually caught his eye. And I said, "Hey, I love you." And he was really taken aback. He kind of, you know, his eyes bugged out. He didn't know what to say. And then he said, "I know." And the next time I looked up, he wasn't there anymore. They had moved him.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, there's so much to talk about, Lisa, and we don't have too much time, but I want to ask you a few more questions, if I may.
Yeah.
It wasn't too long after that, so one more story. January 2019, that you and I and a few friends like Shane Claiborne were arrested for opposing the death penalty. All we did was stand on the steps of the Supreme Court on the 40th anniversary of it starting again. We had that massive banner that read "Stop Executions." It was such a lovely witness. And then we were arrested. Now, I've spent a lot of time in jail, been arrested a lot. But that was a pretty tough action for me, and it was a very holy experience. I wonder if you could share briefly a message about it, or why, a memory of it, why you did it, what you learned from it, or any other thoughts about that experience.
Yeah, I mean, I will never forget that, because I was not expecting to spend the night in jail.
Well, in that kind of jail, too. My cell was covered with cockroaches.
Roaches. Yes,
unbelievable.
That's right.
The DC Central cell block, place I know well.
Yeah, it's notorious for that, actually. And we were three stories below ground, so there's no air. It was hot. I mean, hot as anything. You could barely breathe, and all they had was like this fan that would. It was in the hall of the between the cells. It was horrible, and I remember, you know, I did it because my senior thesis in high school was an argument against the death penalty.
Good on you.
No joking, right? I got an A too. And I was so convinced that this was like, of course, this is such a great argument. I need to send this to Ronald Reagan. he will see the light if he reads my thesis paper. And so I don't know if I ever did, but I remember I was trying. I don't remember if I ever figured out how to. But I was convinced, and I am convinced, that it is evil. And it is evil for many reasons, not the least of which is that it is a final judgment on an issue that is not conclusive. I mean, the majority of cases that come back are actually wrong. They have gotten the verdict wrong because they've been swayed by their bias, their bias against people of African descent. People of African descent are much more likely to be levied the death penalty in death penalty states, and more likely than their white counterparts who do the exact same crimes or worse. And they're more likely to be found guilty of crimes that they did not commit. So if you have such a fallible system, you cannot levy such a final judgment. Let alone the reality that it is not our place to take life. It is only God's place to decide who lives and for what time period. When we decide to take a life, we are playing God. We are contending with God for supremacy. So that's why I did it. I did not expect to spend the night in jail, but I have to say I'm grateful for it, because I will never forget just trying to sleep with those fluorescent lights on that steel bed that literally had no mattress at all, just the steel itself, the walls covered in roaches, and trying to breathe three levels below ground, three stories below ground, and thinking to myself, this is what prisoners have to endure for years. And I was struggling minute to minute. And it just made me realize, I mean, honestly, prison is violent. I mean, prison itself is violent. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, my God, like we levy these huge sentences, 25 years to life, and we think we're doing justice. But honestly, one night in that place is too much.
Yeah.
And, you know, penitentiaries were created as a means for penance, an opportunity for people to think about what they've done and maybe come to a different conclusion, to come to repent. But it's not that anymore. Now it's absolute punishment. And it's torture, actually. It's like a slow torture.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing that more and more as the same system, the same injustice system, is now being levied on non-criminal immigrants who might have overstayed their visas, or who don't have, who are undocumented, and in some cases, citizens who might have said something the government doesn't like, and so they've been swept up and they have been lost and some even killed inside of those prisons. And so I'm sitting here telling you this from Philadelphia, which is very close to Delaney Hall, where we have all seen the horrific conditions that detainees, immigrants, our immigrant neighbors are being held because of the hate that is spewing from this White House.
So after that, shortly after that, I think you founded Freedom Road. So I want to ask you about that, and we won't have too much more time. And then I want to ask you about Jesus in the midst of all this. I remember around the time you started Freedom Road, I invited you to be one of our speakers. I think we were the first event ever, shortly after the unveiling of the Martin Luther King statue around the corner from the Lincoln Memorial. We had a great rally. And then you spoke about Dr. King and nonviolence, and we all marched across to the Lincoln Memorial, and then we went to the White House, and some of us we blocked the entrance to the White House, and the cops refused to arrest us because this was Trump's first administration, and they said, we're not arresting you. We support you. But that was a great day. Well, tell me about Freedom Road, which I always think of in light of that great day we had.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Freedom Road is a consulting and communications group. And so what we do more than anything is we help shape message. We train people of faith to engage that message in the public square, either to amplify it, to speak it, or to do it in the public square. And then we also walk alongside people in actions like the one that you called us to in order to live the message in the public square. And so our trainings span the gamut, anything from a pilgrimage that we contract with a church or an organization or a school to do that takes them through the story of a people group, helping them to understand how this confrontation of powers is happening in our land and what does our faith have to say to it or say about it. Or it could be the formation of a forum, a conference or a summit that someone contracts us to put together and to run for them. It could also be consulting work that we do that helps organizations to do justice more justly. And so we are that shop. And then, of course, we also have all of our social media work, which is Substack is our main place. So if you ever want to connect with me or Freedom Road on any platform, the first place you go is Substack. And then from there, you'll find everything.
Great.
Yeah.
Can you say a word about your books, The Very Good Gospel, or your book, this provocative title, Fortune, How Race Broke My Family and the World and How to Repair It All?
Yes. Well, that's Fortune. Fortune came out in 2022. It was and is a study of my family in order to understand how the breaking of shalom happens in our families and in the world and what the repair of that shalom will require from us. I did 30 years of research in order to write that book. It didn't start as a book. It started just from me doing family research. But then as I was researching, I started realizing this is not just the story of my family. This is really the story of America, because I found that my family story reaches back to 1682 on the eastern shore of Maryland.
Wow.
And intersects with the very first race laws that were ever written. And so each chapter, for the first two parts of the book, each chapter goes through a particular generation and how their lives intersected with public policies that helped shape America.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And what it did to their lives, right? And then finally, the last part of the book is three essays on truth-telling, reparation, and the beloved community.
And your book, The Very Good Gospel?
The Very Good Gospel came out of 13 years of wrestling over, what is the good news of Jesus? And when I took a pilgrimage in 2003, I was really struck at the end of that summer. It was a 4-week pilgrimage, if you can believe that, literally 4 weeks on a bus in lots of different hotels, going across the northern south for the first 2 weeks in the Cherokee Trail of Tears, and the deep south in the last 2 weeks for the African experience in America from slavery to civil rights. And I came to the end of that baffled by this singular question: what would my great-great-great-grandmother, who was the last enslaved person in my family, how would she respond to my understanding of the good news at the time, which was God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life, but you are sinful and therefore separated from God. And Jesus came to die to pay the penalty of your sin. And all you need to do is pray this little prayer and you get to go to heaven. What would that, would she jump for joy from that message? And I, when honest with myself, I had to say no. So then that led me into 13 years of investigating the biblical concept of shalom that brings together justice and the gospel all into one, under one umbrella of a concept. And you begin to understand how this all works together. So that book is my attempt to understand the biblical concept of shalom and to share it with the church.
Oh, that's great. Just what we need. And so my last question would be about Jesus. As you know, throughout my life, I've been trying to teach and study and promote, in particular, the nonviolence of Jesus, because you know, all these Christians were so insane with violence and whatever your favorite variety is. Let me just ask you to share however you want any insights you might have about the nonviolence of Jesus, his passion for justice, his total inclusivity, his, I call it universal compassion, universal love, and his public peacemaking, and his steadfast nonviolent resistance to empire, which is why he was executed. And then I think even resurrection of the nonviolent Jesus is all about nonviolence, because it means you can have nothing to do with death. Lisa, give me your take on the nonviolence of Jesus and what that means for us as Christians today in the world of Trump.
Well, I think it's really important to place Jesus in his actual context and to understand him there, that Jesus was an indigenous man. Jesus was indigenous to the land. Jesus was a colonized man, serially colonized by multiple different empires, his people. His people have been serially enslaved. And he lived in as a subject within the Roman Empire, not a citizen, a subject. And that empire believed, as Plato and Aristotle did, especially Aristotle, that there was a hierarchy of human belonging. And basically those who were not like the Romans were, and those who had been conquered by the Romans had proven that they were created to be enslaved. So the Romans who put him on that cross, they would not have actually seen him as fully human. So when you look at nonviolence, I mean, nonviolence, more than anything, is rising from the communities that have been violated by the logics of domination. And so empire and colonization have come in, and they have done violence in order to subjugate and control people so they can extract from the land, and they can extract both goods from the land and people from the land for their own good. Nonviolence is the way to fight back for people who are not on the upside of empire, because you don't have an army to fight you, to fight for you. And you begin to understand the value of coalition, the value of bringing different people groups together. And that is really what Jesus did. Even when you look at his 12 disciples, they were this ragtag coalition. I mean, they had different factions of groups that were at war with each other inside of the Jewish community at that time, the Israel community. And yet Jesus brought them together to be the 12. Well, that 12 did not start as the 12. They were created. And just even like the makeup of the 12 is a nonviolent strategy. And it's a nonviolent way of life. So I'm instructed more than anything else in terms of nonviolence by Jesus's Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes. And I really do believe that when he said, blessed are the peacemakers, for theirs is the kingdom of God. I mean, they shall inherit the earth. I think he really he knew that. He was saying something he actually believed. It's not just a saying. And it's because the logics of domination are in direct opposition to God. And ultimately, the logics of domination are attempting to dominate God because they're trying to dominate the image of God on earth. So nonviolence is really the only way to not be at war with God when contending for freedom, for liberty.
Wow, that's a great note to end on, and that's so beautiful and inspiring. I wish I had more time. So, Lisa, we're going to have to talk again.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Lisa Sharon Harper, for speaking with me today. And thank you, friends, for listening to the Nonviolent Jesus podcast. You can hear more podcasts and find other upcoming Zoom programs at beatitudescenter.org, where you can also sign up to receive our free e-blast with news about upcoming podcasts and Zooms. You can help me, please, by telling all your friends and coworkers and people at church about this podcast. And also, I hope you'll get my new book, Universal Love, Surrendering to the God of Peace. And if you're on Substack, besides looking up Lisa, you can look me up at Father John Deere. So may the God of Peace bless you all. We keep on following the nonviolent Jesus and resisting war, racism, fascism, and injustice, and working for a more just, more nonviolent country and world. See you next time. God bless you.